Today we are going to discuss how Dr. Muhammad long term is in this matter. What the department is going to do, trying to look at how we can help us with the challenge of climate change. We have to ask the member of the parliament to evaluate whether or not we are in the right path or if there are more activities to be done. We have got the information from the department, the director, who will take the full decision. After this presentation and after our exchange, we will go through the remaining units. After so that also on the technical and scientific side we will have.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honourable members.
Good morning.
As you'll recall, the long-term mitigation scenario process, the RTMS, was presented in some detail at the relatively workshop. And it was also launched and presented at the Minister's Breakfast as well. So I'm assuming that members all have the booklet, which is the RTMS document. But if you don't, we've actually made copies for reference, soft copies. In essence, unfortunately, we've already given members three copies each. We've run out of copies now.
I've never seen it before.
We've
the hard copy.
Available at the workshop and at the venue. Yes.
Never.
What will you recall? Does anyone recall this person?
No.
Never
received.
We are not an unconscientious. But all of us, I think the market is some
input. Well, sure enough, we're not only every month we send on a pack.
Ready?
To you.
They are so good, they are so
well, they're very well thought out, and what we'll try and do is we'll certainly try and get hard copies to you if that's not possible. If you have soft copies with you, they don't look as nice, but they contain exactly the same information. In essence, you'll recall that the RTMS process was a major cabinet decision to have to start exploring what kind of mitigation options we have for climate change. And the basis of that simply is that although South Africa is not a large contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, only about 1% globally. If one looks at our emissions per capita, and if one looks at our carbon intensity of our economy, we do not look very good at all. In fact, we look exceptionally bad. And the reason for that simply is because we're exceptionally energy inefficient, and we basically have a coal-based and fossil-based economy. The inefficiency aspect is dramatic, and the way it's been put is that South Africans have abused the privilege of cheap electricity to become the most energy inefficient nation in the world. It takes us 2, 3, 4 times more energy to produce a product as anybody else in the world. It's because we waste. And many of those wastes lie in areas like industry, for instance, one of the low-hanging fruit, where some of the bigger mega industries was built in the 50s and 60s, and still operate electrical motors from the 50s and 60s. So they'll probably be rewired, every time you rewire it, you get less efficient and so forth. And we still operate them. And the reason for this is because electricity has not been a cost driver in our economy. It's only now with the electricity crisis that people are actually starting to speak about energy, really. Before that, I mean, it was clearly assumed that if you press the button, lights would come on, motors would start running. The electricity crisis has brought home that this is something that we've grown to rely on, and we've certainly realized how much we've been abusing it. So with that, Cabinet made the decision that we needed to explore these kinds of situations. I mean, it's just obvious that in the international negotiations around climate change, the only way the planet is really going to survive climate change is if the planet does something together. No country can do anything like this and I go W Bravo, is if we manage to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, we would still be impacted by climate change and no one else did that. If we decide not to do it, then the consequences of that would be that the world would look at us and say, wait, they didn't either. And the consequences are dire. I mean, if we don't start mitigating, then I don't want to tell you the doom story, but I mean, the consequences are dire. And in terms of third review, the costs of inaction are 5 times higher than the cost of action. So if we do nothing, we basically are telling our children that they will be paying for our mistakes with their lives. That's what we do. And of course, we never do that. So this was an exploration of what is the situation, where are we heading. And with that, two particular scenarios emerged. The first one was looking at our, at what we call growth of our system. And that was just a thought, a process of saying, if we were in a world with no constraints, the world remained cheap, there was no premium on coal, no dramatic climate change, and we basically kept our behaviors as they are now, and our growth path as it is now. Doing things like, for instance, with cheap electricity, encouraging very, very energy where would we go? And this scenario was called growth of in essence, what that did was our global greenhouse gas emissions fourfold. We at the moment were sitting around 440 megatons of carbon a year. We would grow to 1,300 megatons of carbon. Then we said, well, what does the science say? And the science is quite clear on this. In order to at least try and maintain global temperature increase to below 2 degrees, which in itself is, has impact, but there's no doubt we already see the impact of 0.86 degrees. At 2 degrees, those impacts will increase. But to try and maintain global temperature below 2 degrees, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says global emissions have to reduce from between 60% and 80% based on 1995 levels, which is a dramatic reduction. It basically means that the global use of energy changes dramatically. We said from the scenario building team side that South Africa is a developing country with major commitments to poverty alleviation, what have you, is unlikely to be forced to have those kind of reductions in scenarios. However, there is no doubt that we are going to have to pay our part. And so we modeled a thing called required by science based on a negotiated reduction in emissions of between 30 and 40% on our 2000 emission level. So you can imagine we have this graph that leads upwards, and there's a massive increase in this graph that goes down and shows us the reduction. And then the scenario building team started looking at how do we do that. How do we move from this? On the growth of our constraint model to the final outcome. Before it did that, the scenario building team said, well, how robust is the growth of our constraint model? And it was just obvious to everybody that, first of all, its basic assumption that there would be no global climate change meant that we would follow the growth of our constraint path, but we'd expect the rest of the world to change. That was highly unlikely. We also realized that in that sort of situation, South Africa would become a complete global pariah. If the rest of the world is trying to reduce carbon, we were. We would have pariah status. And therefore, we saw that the growth of our constraint models, and was agreed by the scenario building team, that it was just an untenable situation because of that. So what we need to do is how do we move from that line to the required by science line. And in order to do that, a whole bunch of mitigation options were explored. And there's a whole menu of these options, right from things like looking at energy efficiency in industry, in commercial applications, in residences, in vehicles, transport modal shift, i.e., I'll use an example at the moment. At the moment, we are all suffering from high petrol prices. Or so we say. And yet, if one looks at the amount of vehicles on the road that still have a single occupant, the high petrol price is not push people onto public transport or into at least or even into carpooling.
Mm.
So So people are still paying money. They're still not saying, well, perhaps I should seek my neighbour who also travels this direction and we do travel together. How about petrol cars? We don't do that. So it kind of shows that, for instance, even with a massive petrol price increase, the multi comes. That really hasn't changed our behaviour for those who can afford it, of course. For the people who are using public transport this day, taxis, and so forth, they are really keen because there is no other choice. Just to say. So, in that sort of situation, we look at the whole aspect of trying to, how do we get a modal shift from people out of their private vehicles into public transport, which are far more cost efficient. And we had this whole bunch of options, and then eventually what we decided to do was to just package them into action packages, take a couple of them, and see what they would look like if we made certain policy directions. And the first one we did, action packages, was then called Start Now. And Start Now basically took these various interventions, which were at zero or negative cost. So together, it would not cost the economy or the nation anything. We would actually save money. The argument being is that even if there was no climate change, we should be doing this anyway because it's good for the economy. And those were the big wages of things like industrial energy efficiency, what we call a no-brainer. We must make our industrial energy efficient, use less electricity. And where the climate change is not, we should be doing this anyway, just purely to increase our economic efficiency. However, just taking those no-cost options brought us to a situation where we were only bringing down our emissions by around 30%. So it was a good start, it looked good, but it was not sufficient. So the next set of action packages we looked at was a thing called scale up, and taking those actions and scaling them up. And these were quite dramatic scale up. And I mean, most dramatic of these was that by 2050, I'm not sure how many of us can see, the South African electricity industry would look very, very different. In fact, in terms of the model, it's modeled as 50% renewable energy and 50% renewable energy. And what would that do? And it does quite dramatic. It brings us down to around 50%. It brings us down by 50% by emissions, and that's quite dramatic. Then the next set of options we looked at was saying, all right, let's forget about all these interventions, which are regulatory interventions for those, and let's just use the market. And all we did to do that was to basically charge a carbon tax, to put a price on carbon. And that turned out to be one of the most efficient ways of doing it. Basically, I mean, you don't have to have regulations. All you have to do is put a price on carbon, and the price changes the market. Suddenly, carbon-intensive industries will not become financially viable. And the ones that are, renewable energy sources will have to become very, very economically viable and create their own industries and so on. So the entire industry, the mix of our industry changes purely through economic pressure. And that brought us down to around 75% reduction, which is quite dramatic. The reality is that we never closed the gap. We never closed the gap with purely technical solutions, right? This is the honest truth. We have to also change our behavior. We have to think differently in order for us to really meet that target. There is no quick fix technology that we can plug in, or in this case, unplug, and it'll make a difference. We have to actually change the way we think around the work we do, the kind of way we use energy, and that's the technology that that target. So, that's what the LTMS does. It basically maps out the central future for us, and it provides us with a building block of what we can do. However, the document, although it's policy relevant, it's not policy prescriptive. It doesn't tell us, it tells us what we can do, it doesn't tell us what we should do. It provides us a menu that we can choose from as a nation. So, this is a technical document, and that's why it's broadly circulated, because it's not a policy document. Yeah. It's purely a menu of policy options. Next step, where do we go from here? Now, I have a handout which, if I may, with your permission, Chair, circulate. And it's really, I'm circulating in here. This is a mind map. The actual process itself will be discussed and agreed by Cabinet and what have you. But just to get our thoughts in order about where we're going, this rather detailed looking illustration will give you an indication of what it looks like. If you see twice. Thank you. this flow chart that you that I'm circulating now, the maroon blocks are basically the kind of process elements that we perceive in the next year and a half. The green blocks are the kind of products that we perceive, and you'll see there's a time scale down the side. Once again, this is really a work in progress, and it's just basically to get our ideas thinking about sequencing. As far as this LPMS is concerned, since the sign up by the technical working group in October last year, we have been undertaking a series of high-level discussions with the captains of industry, with leaders in labour, with leaders in the NGO movement, with clusters, with the process clusters, and a briefing capital too. And of course, briefing for yourselves. And from that, we've been taking the discussions and what's been coming out from this in terms of trying to formulate potential policy directions. We've also analysed the current policy environment, including, for instance, the AMP policy declaration for Polokwane and climate change, and other things. What we're doing from this now is we're going to put together a series of potential policy directions to be considered by Cabinet. This broad brushstroke of where we think we as a nation should be heading in terms of the development of a national climate change response policy. We put this forward to Cabinet in May, who said that we need to speed this up. Our initial intention was to send through some policy directions in August. But Cabinet made a decision and said that we need to at least provide them an input into the Lakota. And if the Lakota is the July Lakota as possible on the agenda, then this will be discussed. However, they also made a very, very important point. And in fact, it's a point that's been made by this committee too. Is that the mitigation aspect is all very, very well. But in essence, to a large extent, we still have to do huge amounts of adaptation. Mm. And we have not been concentrating on adaptation. And that is true. The LPMS has an entire section dealing with the impact of climate change, which gives some clues about how we're going to have to adapt anyway. So what we're hoping to do over the next couple of weeks is to also at least start mapping the adaptation areas as well, so that when we have the submission to Captain Potter and to the Fire and Commission Cabinet, that we'll get balance between the mitigation aspect and the adaptation aspect. However, mitigation is relatively easy, because it's just looking at various ways of reducing carbon. Adaptation is far more difficult because you're predicting the future. And although we have some excellent meteorological models and a whole bunch of excellent research in this country and worldwide about the potential impact of South Africa that we'd have to do no matter what, it's quite difficult to actually map that. So what we've started with in the department is a kind of a mapping exercise just to flag where these things may happen. We don't know the extent of these things. And members will have heard this on many occasions, for instance, that with a change in temperature, with a change in rainfall, what happens is that disease vectors like malaria change. The areas that, for instance, never had malaria before because of its weather pattern, if those weather patterns change, suddenly you can have malaria. So that is a risk, and it's something that we have to adapt to. One of the most important aspects, which is the immediacy of this thing, is that adaptation is two-phase. This is on two kind of shows. The one is a kind of accelerated evolution in terms of looking at our crops and how we have to change our crops to where they are and what have you. But the other one is far more immediate, and that is our response to dramatic climate events, cyclones, floods, major fires. I mean, you've seen the Australian fires destroying farms and what have you. That's climate change. It's been drying up the forest and the forest is burning. So those are the kind of emergency response actions which are immediate. And, I mean, if we see how we've actually dealt with, for instance, with people, we may not be actually completely geared up to deal with these kind of issues that we face. So I think our current situation gives us a very clear insight into exactly what our capability is around about these extreme weather events. So there's an aspect of the adaptation stuff where we have to start building up our resilience to climate change and our resilience to and this starts looking at interesting. Now, if one considers it and this opens your mind to it, just think about infrastructure. It means the way that we build a bridge over a river will change. Mm-hmm. Because that river may not have the 100-year flood anymore. The 100-year flood now may be the 10-year flood. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the design of the bridge would have to withstand an extreme weather event. Mm-hmm.
And this goes across the board. And if you think about it, which is what we're trying to do, is to map out what we have to think about. And then with that, put a level of uncertainty against it, and also to try and give some indication to other departments of work that has to be done. Because to a large extent, the Department of Environment, Space and Tourism, really, what is the climate change mandate, other than being the focal point of climate change? The reality is that adaptation is going to happen in agriculture, water, energy, housing, public enterprises, trade and industry, transport. That's where the adaptation work will have to happen. It will have to happen in those line runs. The mitigation work, of course, we have, through the Air Quality Act, we have some legislation tools. But in essence, we've seen that most of our mitigation will have to be in the energy sector, so that's very much the D&E area and the Department of Public Enterprise area. So, what we're hoping as a department is to try and provide people with the areas that they have to start working in, and to provide them with the technical support to work in those areas. So, this is what this shows. Over the next couple of weeks, we are going to turn this off investment to some policy direction. And I can give you some insight of where that's going. And they're not mapped out, but this is feedback from how we, from the feelings we've had from discussion. The first and foremost one is an obvious one. Set a target. You can't plan unless you know where you want to go. So the first thing is to start setting a target for greenhouse gas mitigation. And throughout the process, there's been unanimous support for the idea that the required by science should be our aspirational target. That's where we should go. So one of the policy directions is to start looking at the setting of the target. The next one that's come out very, very clearly is to basically scale up our existing initiatives around the electricity crisis. All the stuff that we're doing around electricity crisis on the demand side is climate friendly. Every time we change a light bulb into a compact fluorescent or switch off lights or turn off air conditioning, what have you, is a climate friendly initiative. And what we really need to do is keep on scaling those up. Not only is it good for the nation economically, it just really relieves the economic burden on the country and makes it far more economically efficient. So that's the thing we should start scaling up. The third area, which is becoming increasingly obvious, and it's completely in line with the theme of the Safer Nation, the Greater the World, is business unusual. We have been exploring a whole bunch of things about business relatively unusual, and within the energy field, the most important one has been nuclear. The push towards conventional nuclear is hardly business unusual, because in Kuburg there is a conventional nuclear power station. PBMR could quite easily be about business unusual. But an area of business unusual that has really not been focused on is renewable energy. And even though we have a new nuclear policy going through cabinet and so on and so forth, maybe for public comment, we have our renewable energy policy is relatively unambitious, to be honest. And certainly in the light of the LTNF, it's really impressive. So in terms of business unusual, I mean, there are huge social and economic opportunities for the country to start looking at businesses that we've never been involved in before, that we actually have huge capacity to do, where we can use the intellectual capacity we have, and that many members will probably know about Professor Olbers' invention of the thin-film photovoltaic cell, which was regarded as the most important advance in photovoltaics in 50 years, which we developed through government. DST paid for development, and eventually was the license to sell to Germany. Technology transfer in the wrong direction. We're just not capturing the opportunity of the nation. And the business unusual challenge says, let's start doing that. Let's start capturing these things and actually become global leaders of our
country. Sorry, Chairperson, can you just elaborate on this investment that I'll make? Sorry, Chairperson.
With a great pleasure. Have you never had a presentation on this? Because it's really worthwhile having a chat about this. It's really quite an interesting situation. The University of Johannesburg approached the Department of Science and Technology and asked them for support for research around a thin film photovoltaic cell. Now, you've seen the normal silicon-based photovoltaic cells, normally solar panels that are being used around the country to power traffic lights and and what have you.
Yeah.
So they're heavy, they're expensive to produce, and they always have to be that square shape. And they're quite, you know, you can't break them, although you can't break them easily, but I mean, they're also relatively sensitive. Mm-hmm. Professor Albert from the University of Johannesburg came up with an idea for saying, let's look at a new technology that's not silicon based, but looking at the kind of resources we have freely available in science. And so I'm looking at a thin film. Think, a technology can be shaped anyway. In other words, it can be shaped like roof sheeting.
Mm-hmm.
It can be shaped like car parts. You know, the roof of a car and the bottom part.
Mm-hmm.
And it should have the same efficiency as a silicon based. The Boston Science Technology gave him the money to develop that. He then went to DSC and asked him for the money to scale up to test whether this would be commercially viable, which DSC of course did. And he built a little factory, and there they were. They were commercially viable. Then, of course, Professor Albert went to science and went to school, give me the money to open a factory. And DSC absolutely correctly says, we don't do that. We don't do that sort of thing. So you had an intellectual, an academic, with a fantastic, saleable product, but he's not an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
So what does an academic do? He publishes a scientific paper. That's what academics do. And of course, the entrepreneurs around the world read the scientific paper and are knocking on his door the next day. So we sold the license.
Sure.
So we sold the license to Helios for the development of SimForm. They've already built it. They've taken our idea, our intellectual property, which we sold to them. And they have a license to manufacture in Germany, and they have a license to sell to the developed world, which of course is the biggest market at the moment.
Good course.
We've retained our license to produce locally and to sell to the south, which of course is the smallest market. But at least we haven't lost it. And in actual fact, the bizarre situation is the SimForm solar panel is marketed in Germany as Johannes, which was made in Johannes. So there's the story. It just kind of indicates to us that we have this kind of intellectual capacity. We have the ability to do these things, to make these new products. But we're missing the opportunity, and I think it's because we're not putting enough emphasis behind it. Not emphasis. That's why in all of these sort of situations, in my various meetings, people have always said to me, Peter, why are you smiling whenever we're talking about the energy supply crisis? And I say it's because it's the greatest thing that's ever happened from the climate change, because we're suddenly thinking about energy. The dinner table conversation has moved away from crime, and now we're talking about electricity, which for me is fantastic.
Yes.
You know, to sit down with people who are now talking about wonderful ways of how they can save electricity in novel ideas,
mm-hmm.
is just astonishing. And there are some really innovative approaches. A typical example would be a company approached me and said, you know, we've come up with a very easy way of saving huge amounts of electricity. We did an audit of our factory and we found that the startup of all our big machines just had a massive drain on electricity. And of course it is. I mean, most of these big machines have big flywheels. And just to get that flywheel just turning, the engine drain. And all they did was they put up a sign saying, turn the flywheel before you switch on the engine. In other words, in the past, people would press the button and the engine goes, try and turn the flywheel. Once it started, that would be fine. Now all they do is they spin the flywheel, turn the engine on, no strain, no electricity load.
Okay.
Massive saving. Simple. Not even technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's behavioral.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole bunch of elements of that that come from that.
Mm-hmm.
So with that said, and going through the plan before you, we will try and present to Lakota, and if it's not, if it can't be considered Lakota, at least as cabinet in August, is a quick summary of the path that come through, plus some of the directions that are coming through. The final directions there from the business unusual must be a whole aspect of cooperation, coordination, and alignment. It's just obvious that the climate change response is a response across government. And not even across government, across society, in fact. And so therefore, there needs to be that kind of cohesion and alignment. We must have the impact being greater than some of the parts. And the only way we can do that is keep those people alive. And the final aspect that we're likely to put forward is thinking of the future. The whole aspect of seeing of really putting our money where our mouth is, to saying, if this is to be the African century, we have to do the research. We have to start looking at the technology development, and we have the ability to do it. The idea that, for instance, that in an African century, for us to be leaders by following is not going to happen. We lead by leading. So that is the kind of emphasis we're trying to do. We believe that, for instance, we're already getting the positive signals from cabinet and yourselves already. There's never been a negative sign when we start going through. We've had a very positive response to these presentations. And so we believe that we'll get that level of political support for this kind of situation. From there, once we have approval on a policy development process, endorsement of the kind of policy direction, we will start facilitating the policy development process. And in essence, that will start with the creation of what we're calling an annotated table of contents. We'll basically do a table of contents for a national climate change response policy, which will be heavily annotated. We'll say a heading and what will be under that heading. And we'll work through that with bilateral with all the affected departments as well to create the skeleton of policy. And then as the minister announced the new budget vote, we will have the National Climate Change Policy Conference in February next year. And with that, we're hoping to not even match, but better the 2005 policy conference with a strong level of participation. And use that to discuss and start putting meat on the bones of the framework. And importantly, to start giving all the affected departments their marching orders. So no longer can we have be in a situation, for instance, where the Department of Transport says, well, this is not really our issue. It is completely their issue.
Mm-hmm.
Department of Health, this is a huge issue for them.
Mm-hmm.
If one considers that climate change to undermine all of our primary health care systems, put massive pressure on these sort of things, it is a fundamental concern of every government department. So hopefully the climate change response policy development process will make it quite clear, and from there we'll have a kind of a plan of action of how the central departments will go through. And with that, towards a draft policy before we go to Copenhagen for the final negotiations of the post-2012 commitment. Naturally, of course, it would not be wise for us to publish our policy before those negotiations, because of course we don't want to play your hand.
Yeah.
Mm. So what we have is at least a very clear draft policy direction of where we go and what our negotiators will be armed with in terms of what South Africa is going to do. We'll go into those negotiations and hopefully we'll have a positive outcome, and a positive outcome will be that there is no doubt that we'll have to take some level of commitment, but that there are huge, far deeper commitments from them. Once that is in place and we have a clear indication of where that's going, then of course we can then finalize our policy to reflect those our international commitments. Okay, that's it.
Thank you very much.
I can't believe it.
I think you can understand because in the departmental public defense workshop that we had in the framework, it's clear the opportunity for the PCT. And that was what we were trying to put into the for some time, this morning, we should plan to get to the PCT. So that's until my comment is talking to me.
Yes, thank you, everyone. Thank you for your submission. Question concerns the global position you have made. One is you said that obviously we have to start saving energy by using public transport. Now, I think that's a big problem because I think we have a very inefficient transport system in this country. And so we might possibly have to collaborate with the Department of Transport in order to get the transport system going. And if that doesn't happen, I think we are probably shouldn't come unstuck. The other problem is the question of nuclear energy. Is there any danger of type of thing or type of thing occurring in this country? we will fall out, how do you store that waste to get that effort? The first thing, the first question is related to adaptation. I think it's first, we don't put the mitigation practice and we do not prevent the emission of greenhouse gases. And we talk about adaptation all the time. Today it has become adaptation really has become more difficult and more costly the less mitigation is taken. And then the other topic for me is I'm not quite sure if the government is more not responsive for the new energy in this country. The final thing is how do we although we might take action in this country and although we might take a lead in the southern development community and the rest of the area on the continent, how do we get highly industrialized countries like the United States, they produce 50% of the greenhouse gases in the world? How do we get these countries to join us in this effort to make it from the change?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you also for the presentation. I'd be interested to know your opinion on two things, and perhaps some more detail, if it's possible. The one is this has been presented to some top CEOs, I think you said. How? There are, for a lot of these things, I guess there's need for increased capital investment, which is a good thing, and I'm sure the internal rates of returns will all be very, very good. How do you envisage, what are ultimately the factors that will get the CEOs to act, besides from the policy which will ultimately come out next year? And I guess what I'm asking is, what instruments are there? Because they're of course in the same quandary as we are as a country, and you representing who acts first, basically. So if you could maybe give us some initial thinking on your ideas, maybe to sectoral responses to climate change. And the second question I'm interested in is, can you give us a sort of status report on the state of the carbon market? I mean, I know there isn't a price for carbon yet, but what instruments need to be developed from a financial point of view in South Africa? And I'm particularly looking at various tradables, and how can the state assist in that process happening sooner than later?
Thank you, Chair. A few quick points. Number one, I cannot resist to proclaim my admiration for Peter Lucky, because he's definitely world school. I mean, he's excellent. Unfortunately, I'm not responsible for your salary. I'm not responsible for your salary.
I wish you were.
The next point is, let us on to what Honorable Mowat has just asked about the carbon. I want to know the CDM, the carbon development mechanism. What is the status of the CDM? Number three, it's quite clear to me, Chairperson, that we must now forget operating in silos. This type of a presentation does not only result here. It means we must make it possible that our minister must say to cabinet, this presentation must be made, not the cabinet, but ministers must each try and mimic what they say, which they cannot. It means there must be made different ministries, perhaps 26 ministries that we have. So now, this information can just spread. It can sensitize everybody. The fourth point is, it's quite clear that we should have, this is not a matter of just environmental quality and protection, which is program two. of one of our six programs, but that we must have a close collaboration now with science and technology. It's quite clear. Well, we are lay people, but I think we must, if we have a joint meeting like that, just as a springboard of closer cooperation, because it's clear that we are oversight over this EQP, and then they are science. And let's get an example of this, Professor Albert. It's just clear what could actually happen if we as government do not go an extra mile. And we'll hear this afternoon the President's debate. Business are unusual. We must begin to actually put our money where our mouth is. That we must begin to do things in a very unorthodox manner. And not say, no, this is the message we have. But if that professor, every time when he made that appeal, he said, can you give me enough money? There was some creativity through Pula or whatever, or IDC, there's money. I mean, IDC, it's such a disgrace. Investors, they've got billions and billions. Why couldn't they actually give the man money? And just said, no, that's not the type of thing to do. And of course, the rest is history. So it links up with our cry of beneficiation. It's a classical example of how we actually fail an excellent idea of being a leader. So that's to belabor the point. But I just think we must actually do that now, have a meeting in that facility to come together and begin to strategize. And perhaps, you know, that type of forum can serve as a springboard for greater things to happen.
Okay. Maybe on this particular position of the engineer component, there is already an initiative that we have to meet up around the energy crisis to help make our own world less accessible, calm, and then begin the particular attend around the energy crisis how it should be. But we're not accountable to that level. So whatever agreement that is that is not fine for us.
Mm-hmm.
We have therefore decided that we will want to interact with all those systems. And therefore even this issue could be part of us the idea for the sort of talk about the feel the conference form of maybe next year,
mm-hmm.
to look at the social challenge of energy and climate change. And how that, so in this issue could fit in very well.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the white are in the world of the world.
Okay.
I think one of the indicating that was
no,
you know,
no, I think I definitely did. Yeah, I definitely saw it. I certainly welcome your presentation. As you have said, that it is going to take everybody to put the shoulder on the wheel. Now, one was wondering what program can we come up with in collaboration with the Department of Education to conscientize the future at a very elementary level, to change behavioral patterns, because that would also have an impact. So that education from the classroom would go to their home, where they could have influence with the parents for the next day. So I think that we can have a program of that nature. Thank you.
It's just a general question. Peter, it's you say we need to change our behavior. You know, as leaders, people will always like to know from you as a leader about certain general things that are concerning energy as such. And only to find that at times you are so ignorant and you start, beating about the bush when you are confronted with certain questions. Just like changing the behavior, switching off of lights, you don't have that other room, what, switching off breathers and what have you, such like things. maybe I need your wisdom just to elaborate just a bit on that. And there's something that worries me most when this load shedding. Okay, you go to the mall, you find that there's no electricity. You look at the what, restaurants or whatever, those who are dealing with perishables. You find that it's going to be there for the whole week. You go to the hospital. You know, such like things. I always wonder, what really happens at the end of the day to those people, you know. I'm just asking things that are quite, you know, practical in our lives. And lastly, can you say something about this load shedding? Is this, for how long is it going to stay?
I can say a lot about that, but I can't do it with any advice.
We've all got a pin.
I think you should ask us to take more. Maybe we can try something. Also, if I can. I think this political process that we're talking about, is it likely to advance into the city? Or is it just a political process that would be I think that we've done many of the decisions that have come to us. You can read policy from because you are more willing to let them destroy the also, similarly, I would think that the parliament might also really want to have public hearing so that again we can bring it as many people, listen to as many voices again, so that we can meet the policy and hopefully it will come sooner. And then lastly, I would like to comment on this issue of the intervention that was put in Germany. I think it's a private business. I think from the point of view of Parliament, I think we're saying that the department must find a new system of business. This is what I said. We cannot have social subsidy that becomes private thing, not even for South African conviction. So I think that this was in the point of view of this committee. Once the department takes effort in the special of the certain ecology to reverse the situation, it was put in the government to fight on this successfully. This is unacceptable. So I hope you can respond to us. We cannot accept it. I'm coming from the conference last week on the dominant thing. Yes? What kind of developing capacity